open a book and it invites you to fall in.
That was my North Star. I always sailed towards that star.
We were all really lucky to be doing what we were doing, no matter how much we complained about it, and there was a kind of a joy in that.
Welcome to the National Writer Series on Interlochen Public Radio. I'm Doug Stanton. Editor Terry McDonnell has worked with some of the most celebrated authors of his generation, but not all of them agreed with his attempts to edit their work. For example, Jim Harrison.
Jim would say that he had thought everything through so carefully before he sat down to write that when he wrote it, it was perfect. He was a poet, and editors don't edit poetry.
Terry McDonnell says he was proud to be part of the new journalism movement in the 1970s and 80s. He's been the editor of many magazines over his career, including Rolling Stone, Newsweek, Sports Illustrated, and Esquire, and he was the founding editor of Outside Magazine. McDonnell is also the author of a memoir called The Accidental Life, an editor's notes on writing and writers, which documents his years working with some of the biggest names in writing. I asked Terry to tell me about The Accidental Life.
I wanted to write about what I knew, which was editing and writing and editing writers. And I realized that why I wanted to do that was because like a wave of vanity had caught up with me over my years as an editor of relatively celebrated writers. I wanted to show myself as a writer. I wanted to show the writers I had edited and everyone else that I could do this too. That was the vanity. And I thought the best way to do that would be to write about writers I knew, because I had detail, not just the getting under the hood part of editing them and how different they were and how similar at the same time, but also what they were like in the writing life, what that life was like, how their eccentricities, what they wanted to talk about, how Jim Salter would never talk about himself, but then he would keep meticulous records of touch football games and send for all of us who played in the games as if they were somehow important, but they made the games more fun. And he did this instead of ever talking about his life as a fighter pilot. And there were many, many meanings in that for me and other things like that. And, you know, it was the life, and it was mine.
Why accidental?
Well, the idea there was that you could be on a career track as a journalist. You could get a job at a paper, get on a beat, you could work your way up, and then in the end you would be higher up, but basically at the same place. And the guy who made me an editor, a guy named Bob Sherrill, suggested that that was the wrong way to look at it. You wanted to have as many different experiences as you could, and you wanted to bounce around, because the joy of, and he coined the expression, the accidental life soars compared to the predictable. And what he meant by that was that it's okay to get fired, it's okay to quit even without having another job, and it's okay to take chances. And if you have the nerve, that will serve you well. And I think for me, that was, although it scared me sometimes, it served me.
He had a motto that was important to you, didn't he, about...
He used to talk about monkeys jumping out of boxes. That was a metaphor for writing, for editing. Get the monkeys to jump out of the box.
I never saw those monkeys in your office. But
you were creating the monkeys. Well, your monkeys I needed to get leaping.
I got to tell you, this is... Go on, yeah.
It's the other thing he would say would be, there's got to be a zebra at the bottom of that Cracker Jack box, or a Cadillac, or something. There was for you.
This is really, I've got about three things I want to say at once, but one, this is an amazing book. If you like reading just about people, if you like reading biography, this book is for you. If you like the gossip of the writing life, and we have so many writers in the audience, and Terry, in this community, This is a book about writing. If you like Stephen King's book called On Writing, this is kind of in that vein, and that if you kind of read between the lines on this, what you're really getting is, it's as if you woke Terry up at 3 a.m. and he started kind of telling you all your secrets about what I would like to see in the piece that you're supposed to write for me. That's how I read your book. You know, I thought I was getting a peek behind the curtain about the editing process, which was very valuable. So,
At least it's not Stephen King talking about himself.
No. He's not in the book. Did you ever meet him?
Sure.
Yeah? Okay.
No, he's a fine writer. What I was doing and what he was doing never aligned. He's writing bestseller after bestseller.
Okay, so everyone, this is like having Gordie Howe on stage if you're a hockey fan this is truly 6 degrees of Terry McDonald. So you're looking at Terry and you see Gay Talese or Hunter Thompson. Do we have any Hunter Thompson fans in the audience? Yeah. So there's just a wealth of information here in this book about all those people. I think the thing I want to talk about Cheryl was that I think you wrote somewhere in here about, you write beautifully, it was a way to live, don't get locked in, take life as it comes, the future and past together in the same moment. And then Cheryl says to you, the other Bob Cheryl was right about, in ITAL, about letting life happen to you regardless of the pain and so on, but with its soaring joy. The accidental life was good that way. I never sensed that when I came into your office. You know, what I always sensed was, and I wouldn't expect to, but...
Hunter once told me, he said, the problem with you as an editor is that you don't let on. You're having a much better time than the writers that you're editing.
You know, I have
and
to
we
agree.
Resent that, you know.
Yeah, no, it was very serious going into your office when I would try to pitch you something. And I was thrilled. I felt like I learned a lot through that process. But I didn't know that this was going on in your head. So that's what I mean by the book being almost like reading a diary in a way, which is its value. We've talked about the title. Just tell us where you entered into journalism in American media post-World War II and really rode a wave to its peak, right?
And now, I was a little late to the new journalism, but I got there, and I had admired it. And this was the usual suspects, and I got to edit them: Talese, Mailer, Tom Wolfe, Hunter Plimpton, and I was in place, as we would say at Time Inc. and Time Warner, until 2012, in a real line job, which meant that the arc of my career was the arc of the rise of the new journalism and then disruption of the digital technology and then the evaporation of viable business models for what we had all loved the most, which was this now called the golden age of magazines.
And it seemed to be a golden age when I hit it, but now we're not in that age anymore. And you actually, though, had an early experience with Steve Jobs kind of at the dawn of this new era. And I wonder if you could just explain, because I think a lot of people are concerned about how they're consuming news today and what even news is. And you saw the early signs of Jobs coming in with his computer.
Well, I love Steve Jobs. Yeah. Steve was, when I met him, he was wearing a tiny little bow tie and an extremely well-cut English suit. And this, I knew where this Steve Jobs was from. I was from 20 miles down the road in the Santa Clara Valley. He's from Cupertino. I get that, and there he is. And he's so young, and he looks so good. And we're at a restaurant. A Washington Post reporter named Tom Zito brought him to dinner. And we had dates, and Steve did not. And we started talking about what he was doing, and he was in town to show people the first Macintosh computer. And he talked about it in such a loving and sort of intuitive way that you just knew he was going to be successful. And what he was saying was, this thing, this was going to be, you're going to be able to shop on it, you were going to be able to get your mail on it, there was going to be all this communication, it was going to be entertainment, it was going to be all these things, which of course at the time, this was not clear, but all of which became true. And I remember the women we were with just were, they thought Steve was great. And looking at him, he said, what are you going to call it? He said, Macintosh. He said, you like the Apple? And he said, duh. Which was another side of Steve Jobs, which I got to know later. Because when we, over all of these years, we sort of kept in touch. One of the swimsuit models was photographed once naked, except for an iPod. And we had that picture. We were not going to run that picture, but I sent it to Steve. It was like really bad, bad boy behavior. But when he developed the iPad, we thought that that was going to save magazine journalism, because if we could only figure out a way to make magazines work on there. And I did the first one of those. And we did it without a Macintosh computer, because Steve wouldn't give us one because of the way Apple's always locked down. We gerrymandered something, and we had a touchscreen. We could do it, and we had this prototype. And when Steve came to Time Inc. to meet with all the editors and the people who run that company to introduce it, he passed it out. We all had one. And by that time, a video that we had done that starts, hi, I'm Terry McDonald, editor of Sports Illustrated, and here's your new issue. And it was all on the iPad. And someone played that, and it ran. And someone asked him, hey, you know what we've got going on here? And we were all thinking it was going to be a time for Steve to really tell us how much he liked this. And he said, yeah, I've seen that. I think that's really, really stupid. Because it wasn't live. And I said, well, you couldn't, you know, we didn't have one of your appliances. He hated that word. One of your appliances to learn on. And he said, well, yeah, the meeting was over. We all filed out. And then I heard about 2 hours later get this call. He said, well, you know, that was all kind of a negotiation in there. Because they wanted us to give up the names of our subscribers in order to get on the iPad and the Apple Store. So that's how I know Steve Jobs.
This is the point in your career when, because there are two parts to your career, I think, the more executive designer developer side, right, in this era. Well, that was more recent. But then there's the part where you were in the trenches working with these writers at Rolling Stone and, as Ann said, in places that you ran. You just weren't at the top of the masthead, but you were.
No, I was at the top of all those mastheads.
But you were.
That's important.
Yeah.
I mean, no, you can't. You have to have the ability to do what you want to do, or you can't do it.
Mastheads are important. If you don't know, it's the pecking order on the magazine, and it's every writer looks and see who's who. And it's always a sad day when you get kicked off the masthead. I don't know, it hasn't happened. Wink, wink. To go back to working with writers like Jim Harrison, who many in the audience know, or Hunter Thompson, or in maybe New York in the 80s, you know, it's another world completely where we're living today. What was it like to be riding this wave of journalism in the 80s in New York?
Well, for me, it was about these people that I was working with, because I became friends with them, or friendly with all of them, really friends with some of them, and they were very, very different. But there was a subtext to everything that they all did, and they shared that subtext, which was that they all knew that we were all really lucky to be doing what we were doing, no matter how much we complained about it. And there was a kind of a joy in that. So it was joyous when Jim would tell me, for example, you lynched my baby, by way of complaining about somebody inserted a semicolon into his copy. And, you know, we can continue to be friends, but our professional relationship is finished. Hunter, you know, Jim would say that he had thought everything through so carefully before he sat down to write that when he wrote it, it was perfect. He was a poet, and editors don't edit poetry. So how could you possibly think, let's talk about what we're going to have for dinner? So that was Jim. Way over on the other side, Jim Salter was so hard on himself about that same semicolon. He would be in, it would be out, it would be in, it would be out, it would be whatever, that you just, with him, you just sent him the galleys and then had him do your work for you. And it was, he was prickly, but he was very careful. Jimmy Buffett did not care. He had a natural voice, and he knew who he was, and he was grateful for editing. I would like scratch across all of his copy and move stuff around. And he'd say, "Oh, that's just great," which I thought I took as a it was a reflection of the great confidence he had in his own talent, because he knew what the voice was, and he knew who his readers were, and it played. This was when we first started together, way before he'd written any books, novels, or Where's Joe Merchant, or any of that.
So what was the story of the 80s? You know, I mean, if you, as an editor, look back and say, okay, I published really six kinds of stories probably in my magazines, you know, what were they?
Well, the 80s were, from my point of view, the much wilder decade than the 60s. At one point in the 80s, I was on Saturday Night Live when I was the editor of Rolling Stone, and it was, the way they would introduce that show would be, you know, live from New York, comma, the most dangerous city in the world, comma, it's Saturday Night Live. And everybody there was kind of proud of that. And they showed all these street scenes, and there were a lot of cocaine, and it was you know, dark noir streets, and it would be completely black, and then you would open the door, and there would be this wild club scene going on inside, and it just felt very alive. And all of the writers that I worked with had their own particular takes on that, and were, you know, totally devouring it as subject matter.
Right. What are we doing? If you were to sit back and you're flying over the United States and you look down and say all the magazines are laid out on across from New York to San Francisco, and you could just absorb and say, this is the story America's trying to tell itself right now. And it's kind of a broad question, but I'm really fascinated by stepping back as an editor and picking out themes that people seem to be obsessed with or writing about or want to read about. You know, can you answer that question, or is it just too broad?
Let me answer it this way. I read in the New Yorker this morning in the Talk of the Town, there is a little item about the very famous public intellectual in France who has started a magazine called America. And it's going to run, there's going to be six issues of it, and it's about America from the point of view of France, explaining America to the French. Which, if you think about it, is another Saturday Night Live skit, but it's also exciting as an idea that they would do that, and they want to answer your question. How we would answer that for ourselves has to be equally ambitious, and what is not encouraging is I don't see a lot of media attacking it on such an ambitious level. Once we have determined, you know, with that class divides are spreading out, and that hillbillies are cranky, and that, you know, all of these things that are constantly talked about on cable television now, and that our president is problematic. And anyway, there's not a lot of big projects about, you know, where the heart of this country is. And you get to that by sending great writers into it to find it. And then, you know, coming back and making sense out of that. And it's a creative literature. That is journalism, too.
So it's like de Tocqueville's come back. France is once again kind of taking the measure of America.
Well, you know, I mean, we all talk about how much we, how smart de Tocqueville is.
Yeah.
You all go back and read that guy. It's not as sharp.
Be better.
Well, no, I mean, it's a naive, but sort of heartfelt bouquet to democracy. But it's showing off, you know, French democracy at the same time. It's constantly comparing. I prefer Hunter's version.
Which is what?
Well, if fear and loathing is one thing, but there has to be joy at the bottom of that because we're up against it, you know. You know, live.
Tell people what fear and loathing is, because not everyone in the audience may know what that book meant or means in literature.
Just the words fear and loathing had such a magical poetic ring when Hunter coined them. And it started with fear and loathing at the Kentucky Derby, a piece that ran in Ramparts, where he first started working with Ralph Steadman, who was the illustrator who sort of defined the graphic thinking of his work, too. And Hunter was from Louisville, and it was, for him, the full flowering of Southern degeneracy mixed with corrupt police and just this horrible. And in the Kentucky Derby had been, you know, you did not say a bad thing about the Kentucky Derby. And then there was that piece, and everyone read it, and people who even loved the Kentucky Derby said, that's the Kentucky Derby, and that is funny. And then he went to politics, and then there was fear and loathing on the campaign trail. And, of course, fear and loathing in Las Vegas. And then it picked up, and now it's part of the culture.
What's the line with the bats? What book is that?
That's Fear and Loathing in Las Vegas. We were just out of Barstow when the drugs kicked in, or something like that, something close to that.
You know, so who's doing that work today? Like, is there a magazine that you like that is probing?
I think the New Yorker is running a lot of interesting stuff online as well as in the physical magazine. There's stuff going on out there, but it doesn't crackle quite the same way because we have so much news, and it's so homogenized, it seems. If you're in front of that fire hose, you know, you're going to get all wet, and you maybe really want something else from time to time.
Can we have too much news, you think?
I mean, well, we can have too much. Too many alternative facts.
Yeah.
That's hilarious. You know, I always think about what Hunter would do with that. You know, it's like...
So what do you think Hunter... What's the story Hunter Thompson would write for the issue of Rolling Stone if you were editing it this January?
Well, you would talk him... I mean, you could talk... I talked him into going down to do the Pulitzer trial by explaining that America did not understand that it had become a tabloid nation, and that he had to help us with that. The Pulitzer trial was about a divorce case between the heir to the great Pulitzer fortune and a young woman who was married to him, and in Palm Beach, and they all had sex and did drugs with each other, all the same people, and it was all over the tabloids, and Hunter said, well, yeah, and I'll be staying at the Breakers, of course. And he did.
Which meant expensive. Yeah.
Yeah, and he said, "I'm in my convertible now, and the gales are lashing the palm trees, and the birds are screaming, and I am driving with the top down, and two lesbians are drinking champagne and telling each other jokes in French." He said,
"That was something he wrote to you?"
That's the lead of that story. No, that's well. I mean, it's almost. I mean, his political incorrectness was profound, but he would always turn it and be on the side of who he was incorrect about.
Right.
And so that's the way he got, how he got away with.
Do you remember where you were when you read that lead? Were you at your desk or in what?
What happened there was I left Rolling Stone and went to Newsweek, but Hunter was so tricky that when he filed things to David Rosenthal and Jan, who took over. He would secretly file them to me, too. So I got that coming on a fax machine, like 11:30 one night, the same time he was giving it to Rolling Stone. I would have been gone for 4 months.
Wow.
His deadline stretched out.
You're listening to the National Writers Series from IPR News Radio. Coming up, Terry McDonnell listens to story pitches from audience members and gives his feedback.
You're listening to the National Writer Series on Interlochen Public Radio. I'm Doug Stanton, founder of the year-long book festival held in the historic City Opera House in Traverse City, Michigan. Let's return to my conversation with Terry McDonnell.
I think, if anything, of this, both this book and this evening is about getting to the heart of what makes a story. And I think by thinking about that, it helps us clarify ourselves in a lot of ways, like what's our story? Not just the one we want to write, but what's our story? And it's hard to say, and it's really hard to say what makes a story. So we've had a couple of brave people email Ann Stanton, and we're first going to start with Joseph Morayo. Am I pronouncing your name? Are you here, first of all? And if you are? Morayo. Joseph, are you here? All right. Joseph, would you come up to the magic wooden stairs? To your future?
I want to say something, though, that this is uncomfortably like a TV show that I loathe. No, you have to come up.
Which TV show is that?
The Apprentice.
Oh, no. Oh, my God. No. Well, you know who that makes you?
I know.
That was my point exactly.
So, hi, Joseph.
Hello.
I'm Doug. This is seeming like a TV show. Now, Joseph, if you don't win this evening, we do have an all expenses paid. It's a weekend in Sutton's Bay. I hope you enjoy it. So you've written this pitch, which Terry read and thought was cool, and I'm just going to read the first paragraph, and then why don't you just take it from there? And the point of this is to have a look behind the curtain about what it's like to be in an editor's office and get some feedback, and maybe it'll be helpful to you. So I'll read it just because maybe in the third, another voice, you'll hear it differently. The working title of the article I'm proposing is, quote, Chauffeur Me. I drove limousine in Palm Springs, California from the early 1980s into the 90s. I had a front row seat for the decade of decadence. It was a time when a seasoned driver would carry a small mirror with him so his clients in back won't be chopping on the woodwork with razor blades. That's the first paragraph. Let me go on to the second. I'll be using the familiar format of a day in the life with anecdotes and observations about some names you will recognize. So, how do you want to do this? You know,
I don't know. I mean, it just struck me as something that I could lash together and drag out of you and run in any number of different magazines with a different point of view, because it has this inside information, probably by paragraph two, I'm thinking, probably about some well-known people. And then on paragraph three, I learned that Bob Hope was really cheap and never tipped. And then I've got Malcolm Forbes and Elizabeth Taylor and all of this as the thing stretches out.
Well, I wanted to save the big names for the last. I wasn't going to use the day in the life, and I basically was using, well, what I termed the bachelorette party from hell, and then used the antidotes, you know, as you go along, and there would be pauses in the stories, like how one of the antidotes, Bob Hope was loathed by the limo drivers in Palm Springs because he always wanted his cars comped, he never tipped, and don't even think about an autograph or a picture. And so it was always a new guy that was driving Bob Hope.
Well, yeah.
And then you'd go up and go, expect a big tip.
But there's that, and then there's, you know, you do not mention cocaine, but you so cleverly dodge around it, I realize that you can write a little bit. And this is nuanced. So this is a story that I would assign at Rolling Stone like that.
Well, thank you, sir.
Yeah.
Wow.
How am I supposed to come back to that?
No, you know, you're... So,
but why does it make it... What is the story?
It has disclosure. It has a kind of glamour. It has celebrity. It has, you know, weirdness. It has decadence. It has, you know, day in the lifeness of it. Or, I mean, it's just all of the things sort of keep rolling on, and it's not... Well,
how many words is the story? Because that tells us where it's going to be in the magazine, right? Where would you place this?
You could play this story a bunch of different ways, depending on how long you wanted to go with it. You really could.
What would make it a great story, though? I don't know you. I think I like it. I kind of feel like I've heard this story in some way, but I think it could be a great story, but I don't know what would make it.
Well, that would be my job to pull the uniqueness out of there. So there would be things that even a sophisticate like you would be surprised by. Yeah.
Well, I'm still, yeah.
And what did you think of my closer with Malcolm Forbes?
I thought it was great. That made me like it even better. I didn't like your come behind the velvet ropes. That's cliche to me, but you know, Joseph Drive was good. Yeah. That's when Malcolm Forbes is springing Elizabeth Taylor from the Betty Ford Clinic. And he's driving the getaway car.
Thank you, Joseph.
You want to talk about your pitch?
My what?
Want to talk about your pitch?
Which one?
The first one. You don't have to.
No, I do.
And then your duplicitousness about John Mellencamp.
Yeah. Well, you know, what I liked about Joseph is, you know, when you hear those words, I like it, I'd run this in Rolling Stone. You hear that, your hair goes back, and then your first thought is, how am I ever going to do this? But that's when you smile and say, well, that's no problem at all. I just know how to do this. And that's exactly what I did with you. You just learned this, but I had no interviewing experience whatsoever. I was been a, quote, poetry.
Let me set this up for you.
Okay, all right.
I get a letter
wait,
from...
Wait. He's always editing, isn't he?
No. I get a letter from Jim Harrison, says... I never do this, but a good friend of mine's kid's not too bad. And then I get a letter from, you know, from Doug, and the kid is not too bad. And he writes this essay that Ann talked about. And then we say, okay, we'll give you an assignment. And I think, the Midwest, John Mellencamp, there must be a connection here. So we call Doug and say, what about John Mellencamp? And I didn't hear it on the phone the way I should have, because he was saying, I wonder who John Mellencamp is. But what he said was, great, John Mellencamp. Back to you.
Yeah, back to me. Actually, I was in your office. And
all the worse.
Yeah. And you said, that was okay. What do you think? And so I said, I love him. Man, he's my favorite singer in the world. I've got every album. And then you said, really? Like, you were surprised that really about any of that. Maybe I was a bit over the top. And you said, well, listen, go see if you can make it happen. I had no idea what that meant, but I went out to the, you gave me a Kathy Shanker's phone number as publicist. So I went out, this is the days of payphone. I went out into your hallway and I dialed her number and I said, hello, this is Doug Stanton calling from Esquire, which is true. I had just arrived there 20 minutes earlier, but I was calling from Esquire. And I said, we'd love to do a cover story of John Mellencamp. I didn't know if it was a cover yet. I figured it would be. She goes, really? And I said, yeah, we're interested. So I hung up and then went back into your office. You were actually doing something else by then. And I said, you know, they're in. You go, oh, great, you got the job.
You know what else?
What?
I just realized The one thing we never did, writers could never do, was promise a cover. Because if you promised a cover, then you would promise a cover, and I always wanted to keep the word of the magazine, and you could not do that. You could not work for me and promise covers. And there you did.
I wasn't really working for you yet. I had just kind of... I was trying to get the job.
I did not know this.
Yeah. That's the issue with the Jim Salter story from American Express with the woman on the cover, and he had this great spread inside of Mellencamp painting his face. But yeah, that was fun. But I think I got paid $5,000, but my expenses were about $28,000.
And those were the days. You got 10 and or at least 7.
No, I got 5. I was here painting the nursery, and I thought, man, I'm never going to have to work again. This $5,000 is going to go so far. And then I woke up, and I realized, oh, man, it's already half gone, and that's when you put me on contract. And I got this gig, but that's really how it happened. Which begs this other question, how do writers make it today? You met with the Front Street Writers today. I don't think they could do it. They couldn't scam you the way I just did, or anybody. So what are they supposed to do to make a living?
Well, that's unanswerable, but also, you know, you can carve it up. The ones who are most successful now, coming up the fastest, think of themselves as brands. And they will do a piece for $3,500 for Harper's in order to get on a television show that'll pay them $500 an appearance if they can hook up with CNN or some point, and they will tweet so that their audience will be bigger, and it's about disseminating the news, but it's also about that brand building. And that works for a lot of people now, but it encourages a kind of intramural competition, which is like what we're seeing now, the coverage of Washington, and you can be preoccupied with that as opposed to actually doing the journalism. But if you think about it, that kind of brand building was at the heart of the most successful writers that I dealt with in the 80s, 70s, 80s, like Hunter and George Plimpton and all of them, you know, Tom Wolfe, Talese, all those guys, you know, had something like that. And I think a reason for the solidarity that they felt, and it wasn't just that they were running into each other in green rooms, it was that they recognized that the other one, that the rest of them, that some of them, they in each other, they would recognize this persona that had been built that was not quite real, and that living in it was not always that comfortable. And that could account for a lot of the drinking, or, I mean, I don't, you know, we don't want to go down that road right now, but they, it wasn't always wonderful. But it seems thinner now on Twitter than, you know, it did. Does that make sense, Doug?
It does. I hadn't thought that the white suit of Tom Wolfe and the cigarette, the cigarette holder of Hunter Thompson, we could go on, was really their form of social media.
Because you had to see it. And
they were
socially manipulate media, manipulation of what you're a part of. That's kind of what I'm doing here, selling this book.
Right. It just seems cheaper today, though, because the publisher always wants you to go on Twitter and Facebook and constantly promoting yourself and tweeting, you know, and you hire people to tweet in your name, and it's just a different, I don't know.
It doesn't always feel right if it's not authentic. And the best advice that I ever got over all these years, over all the different things, and what I tell people is that if it's not authentic, people can tell that. And when they can tell that, they do not like it.
Have you ever sent an authentic tweet?
I had a position. I was very early into Twitter, but I couldn't. I didn't want to be the editor of Sports Illustrated doing a lot of that. I wanted to have remove, and I wanted all my writers to tweet their opinions and their whatever, but I didn't want to have a voice right. for Sports Illustrated that I would have been because of my position in the thing. So I haven't really. What?
Has the medium become kind of the message? You know, you've got these people at MIT who's, you've told me, with algorithms, they think they can engineer journalism. I mean, a tweet is not news, or is it? News.
Well, you break news on any platform you want. I think I have a couple thoughts about this. One is that there's an MIT class where journalism is taught as an engineering problem. This is ambitious. I like it. Everything that I learn about that from Joey Ito and these people is fascinating to me. But at the same time, I see the strongest, most, really the bravest originally, big traditional media companies being brought down by a lack of innovation and creativity. And that lands when, because the business plan is not working or faltering, you've got to cut costs. So where are you going to cut those costs? Well, not from your digital development, because you know you got to do that now, and that's also really very much cheaper. But you've got these very expensive editors over here who are supposed to be doing all this creative, nuanced packaging work and, you know, whatever it is they do besides ride around in the radio cars that you buy for them or pay for. And so they go. And they are replaced by people who believe, they are replaced more and more by people who believe that you can, in fact, engineer creativity or engineer, you know, the best journalism, and you cannot do that. It takes the packaging, it takes more than that. And as the stuff comes out the other end, it becomes more and more homogenized. That's why when you're on the web, all of these headlines seem the same. And that lead that we got from Hunter, that's not going to appear anywhere. And it's just there's just a sameness to it all. And that's one reason why some of the magazines that are still working out, because people will pay for them, and they should because they're high quality, you can still find that stuff. But that we're right in that right now. I hope that doesn't sound bitter, because I'm really a digital developer, ouch.
Well, here's a story that is somewhat within this universe. Is Lon Cameron here? Can the lights come up? Are you here? Come on up. I was just reading the first. Hi.
Hi there.
Hi. It's such a pleasure.
No, it's mine.
Okay. Well, listen. Why don't you just give us the elevator speech here, and then because we.
It's a different kind of pitch.
Sure. So, the story is writing a kind of apologetic love letter in a way to millennials because they're so misunderstood. Like every other generation that came before them.
Yeah, but differently.
Definitely.
I love the idea that you're playing around with, but I got to talk to you about how you're going to execute it.
Okay.
There was a famous series that ran in Esquire long before I got there, where different writers of a different generation would, you know, of each generation would write about their generation. It was inspired originally by the Who song, My Generation. Really.
Yeah.
And it allowed people with voice and a lot of attitude to throw a bunch of stuff out there that was enlightening for other generations and also for their own generation because of the detail and the stories they told. So if we were working together now, I would want to know, well, what story most exemplifies the frustration of your generation or the kindness of it, or I would want that about everything. What do you eat?
Mm-hmm. I cook most of my own food.
Yeah? Do you kill it first?
I could. I'm
right,
not afraid of that.
But I would want to know where you stand on that.
Right.
As a generation.
Well,
I mean, are you the people that brought us that gluten-freeness?
Probably.
But you see where this can go as a story. There can be.
Well, again, one of the things that I think it's important to note is, and I'm not like giving myself a compliment here, is I look younger than I am. I'm 45, and so there's this aspect of my experience that is very much dictated by an extension of my young life, which was being Gen X, this sort of beaten generation that was really trying to find hope after the Cold War childhood that we endured, and finding this way to the idealism that some of our parents had. I often joke that I was raised by hippie wolves. So my stories are very much informed by my parents' extreme political leanings, and they were White Panthers and super involved in stuff. So my childhood was extremely interesting and colorful.
So that made you a vegan?
No, I'm not a vegan. I said I could kill my own food if I wanted to.
No, well, but that was like a high curve you threw me.
Sure.
So I want to, you know, keep fooling with that, with those ideas. I mean, because is there a vainer generation than yours?
Than Gen X?
Yeah. I mean, aren't you the ones who are always talking about I, and you're talking about yourselves and that point of view and tweeting about yourself, just everything is just...
I thought that boomers were the me generation.
I don't know. Tom Wolfe called them that, but only because you guys hadn't arrived. I mean, I think...
Fair enough.
Yeah, I don't know.
I mean, how could I possibly, like, retort...
But no,
I'm not giving you the microphone.
No. What I mean is, if you go through this and start making lists of this stuff, you'll have a lot of really good detail.
Right. And I think that there's an aspect of it that has a lot to do with this intergenerational awareness. It's like, basically, like, you're assholes, you're assholes, you're assholes, you're grown up now, okay, you're okay.
So that's your lead. Right?
Okay.
Well, it gets, look, it got there, it got a laugh and attention. Mm-hmm. And if I put the right headline on that, vainest generation ever, or something, it wouldn't be that. But then, you know, you'd be rolling.
I'd be okay with that.
No, but of course you would. But we'd be rolling now. And we could get through the story. We could get to about strange pets or whatever.
Also, it's the way she said it.
Yeah.
You actually were writing the line right there, because it was coming out of this place that wasn't really writing. Yeah. You know, and you just captured it. So
you have an assignment also.
Great. Go.
Just talk to Doug.
Okay. Yeah. Thank you.
There are these, the Me Generation essays are collected. You can find them, and that's what they were called. And I read them all. They're great. So.
Yeah, right.
All right. Well, thanks.
Thank you.
Yeah, okay. I think you're great.
All right, well, let's do one last one. It's called Spearing Dinner. Basically, 200 miles from Florida, the third largest barrier reef in the world separates the Atlantic Ocean from the shallow waters of the Bahamas. It goes on to talk about, you know, it sets it up. It's a lot of exposition. Not really getting to the story yet. But having spent winters in the Bahamas over the last 10 years, I've been intimate with the reefs. This year, I will sail them, and I want to go... free diving for lobsters and fresh fish, and basically take you around the Bahamas and the Abacos and kind of lead you by the hand in the way you would for Outside Magazine. Now, that we were talking about this, and I said, that's a story I've seen a lot. But then,
no, the kicker in there is, just in order to make this more interesting, he wanted to take Doug Stanton with him.
Yeah.
Does he not?
Oh, Brian, there you are.
Oh, good.
Yeah.
Well...
But you had a better idea.
Well, I thought, you know, that would really work, and that lit another bunch of ideas in my head, but you just don't want to take Doug Stanton.
No.
That's the way you want to do a profile of some really high-end person who is really not identified with having any sort of expertise in physical world stuff. There's Fran Lebowitz, who is... wonderful Fran, E. Jean Carroll took her camping, and it was wonderfully funny, and it was a great way to do a profile of,
well, you
of
said,
Fran. But I was just thinking, I mean, wouldn't it be great to, that would be an interesting way to do a profile of Kobe Bryant in retirement. No, take him spearfishing.
But how?
I don't know. You could plug in almost anybody, and it gets interesting. The more, you know, the more counterintuitive it is, and that's a thing that a lot of editors do. It's a pretty standard trick, but this could work a lot of ways.
So when Brian, can you bring up the lights, Michael? Just raise your hand, Brian. It's a great idea. It's nice to see you. But when you said that to me, Terry, so how does he get? He actually said Jay-Z. How do you get Jay-Z to go on the spearfishing expedition?
Well, you call up and you say, "Hi, it's me from Esquire, and I'm here to promise you a cover story." Yeah, or even, you know what, he does, that would be a way to get to Johnny Depp, who is a big snorkeler, but who doesn't want to do anything with anybody, but might go snorkeling with you if you could show him where he could dive and get those illegal lobster that twinkle in your eye is about, I think.
All right, well, as long as we have the lights up, let's take some questions from the audience. We have microphones roaming around. Just stand and say your name, please. Anyone? We got the front row here.
Terry, your time at Time Inc. brought you to Sports Illustrated, and I was just wondering how you could characterize the culture over there. And Mark Mulvoy, if you worked with him at all, and his Boston ingrown culture there, and his BC Mafia. Did you have to penetrate a wall there at Sports Illustrated?
Sports Illustrated was a very tough place to go into. Especially because I had not been a sports editor, but Mark turned out to be a great ally of mine. Mark Mulvoy was, after Andre Laguerre, the most successful editor of Sports Illustrated, and he was from Boston, and he loved hockey, and he was hard-driving and tough, and he hated the management of Time Inc., was just against everything they wanted to do. He wanted his own independence. So when I got there, I said something not particularly wise or sage about, you know, the way the company's being run, and we have to do some things. And he got right behind me, and he said, "Terry's right. Editors should run this company, and he's the editor who should run it." And he was like, he ran interference for me. So it was wonderful. And it turned out I was in that job like a year longer than him. But we, too, have the record along with whatever. But that culture was a business culture that was changing in the way that I thought that they were running around thinking they were trying to catch falling knives, as they say on Wall Street. It was just they're terrified, but they're looking for solutions. There was an editorial culture that was, you know, tight, didn't want to let anybody in. And this editor was deeply suspicious of anybody inside or any of the new technology. And it had an IT department, which was emerging as one of the most important, that were bitter because the other two groups thought that all they did was, you know, were responsible for the air conditioning or what happens if the elevators don't. So it was completely dysfunctional. And that's why all that trouble.
You're talking about how things operate. Where are women in this whole universe now in 2017? Because, you know, they're there. We have a mutual friend, Susan Casey, who won, you know, she's been here actually on this stage. So talk about that just for a moment, because women's magazines and men's magazines have had this.
Well, the worst thing about it when I was starting was that women, you know, ran a lot of magazines as the number two or the number three. When I got to Rolling Stone, there was Jan who owned it, and there was me, and then there was one, two, three, four women. The creative director, art director, the copy chief, the person who ran research, and the top features that are all women. And the most... I mean, it even sounds, cloying and kind of creepy for me to talk about it like this, but they used to say, well, you know, she's a great number two. And if you had said that about a man at that time, it would have busted his career. But there was no consciousness, no awareness of this, the way we were doing it. And as women began to point this out, things began to change in the sense that there was more jargon about it, but it didn't really change very much. And if you go and look at those mastheads now, there are some more women on the top of those mastheads, but it's nowhere 50-50. It's more like banking. You know, it's like 70-30 or something. And when I started, a man ran all the women's magazines at Hearst. John Mac Carter was responsible for all of those, and he was considered a genius. It was like, women occupied his office and smoked cigars and made him understand that they should maybe supply daycare or whatever. It was a huge, huge thing and a big success in the women's movement.
But there is movement forward. I mean, it's changing, I would imagine.
Yeah, the problem now is that there aren't enough women in engineering, I think, in the way that the media is cracking. And that's kind of like banking, again. It's not, they're not recruited out of schools in the same way, or graduate schools or whatever. And reporters, and if you do a breakdown of graduate journalism programs, there are more women in those programs than men. Just like in law school, there are more women than men. But it's not reflected in the leadership.
All right, that's one more, and then we'll adjourn to the lobby. Hi, yes, Meredith.
It seems that the most important thing is an authentic voice that you're looking for in an author. Yet you edited all these very disparate geniuses and made each voice unique. Could you talk a little bit about how you edit such different people and leave them themselves?
Well, I agree completely with what you said about voice, but you know, Hunter again, he would say, "Let the big horse run," or "Let the big dog eat," and that was the way. That was him saying, "Don't mess with my voice." And McGuain used to say, "Well, you know, Terry, I wrote that on purpose," and then you would think, "Wow, what am I undermining?" Something that a great talent has thought through, and then you would feel bad and whatever. And Jim would just say, "Wow, you know, they don't edit poets."
Do you think you found your authorial voice? You've had an editorial ones for so long, and many of them.
I don't know. Maybe not. It's hard.
Yeah.
This I could write this book at a distance because I was writing about other people. There's very little in there about me or me having opinions as opposed to me pointing out something that actually would happen or a detail of, you know, what hurt someone's feelings or, you know, where we all went.
Well, listen, on that note about voice, let's say thank you. And really, thank you very much.
That was Terry McDonnell talking with Doug Stanton. Terry McDonnell's memoir is called The Accidental Life. Learn more about the National Writers Series and upcoming events at nationalwritersseries.org and listen to past programs at interlochenpublicradio.org. For Interlochen Public Radio, I'm Linnea Melcarrick.